My name is Ben Greenfield, and on this episode of the Ben Greenfield Life Podcast.
There are writers that people read because their sentences are beautiful. I'm not one of those. The reason people read my stuff is because I tell the truth. 2020, I'm like, man, this seems weird, but it did not reach the level for me. There's some sort of group of high-level people coordinating. The moment when I thought something was way off.
Sovereign individual, and yeah, defense is going to be a natural byproduct of that, not so you can go to war, but just so you can protect your family.
You can stop the people who are trying to go to war on you.
Faith, family, fitness, health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and a whole lot more. Welcome to the show.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores.
especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. All right, folks, my guest on today's podcast, I probably should have interviewed a long time ago because I've known him for quite some time, and he is a prolific author who can probably pronounce prolific better than I can pronounce it. He has written 4 New York Times bestselling books. 3 of them have hit number one. They've sold over 4.5 million copies around the world. He's actually credited with being the originator of the literary genre fratire, which I think has something to do with fraternity and satire. And he's only the 4th writer, along with Malcolm Gladwell, Brené Brown, and Michael Lewis, to have 3 books on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list, at one time. So this dude can write. He also co-founded Scribe Media, which is a professional publishing company that has published people like David Goggins and Tiffany Haddish and Dan Sullivan. He was nominated Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People list. He lives now in Dripping Springs, Texas, with his wife, Veronica, and his 4 children, and his name is Tucker Max. Tucker, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you, brother.
By the way, does the name Dripping Springs seem kind of funny to you for the town that you live in?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's very Texas, right?
Yeah.
Like, they got water. They're like, oh, we're going to name the town after the water here. Well, there's not much water. It just kind of drips. And like, all right, well, there you go. Dripping Springs.
Yeah, I don't know. For some reason, it seems like the name of like a, or should be the name of like a plumbing company, or, you know, kind of like a Roto-Rooter. Dripping
yeah,
Springs.
Yeah, that'd be a terrible plumbing company name. That'd be like Clogged Toilet or something. It's like, yeah. Who wants to call clogged toilets?
Yeah, that's true. Maybe just a term in plumbing. But anyways, like you, I mean, anybody listening in is probably at least seen the cover of one of your books. I don't know if they've read them, or at least heard of some of your writing, or perhaps stumbled across your writing, or read books that have been heavily influenced by you and your writing. And so this might be kind of a selfish question, but you seem like a really good writer. Like, and I'll link to some of your essays for people listening. You can go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/TuckerMax. But is this something that just always kind of came to you, the ability to just put pen to paper, so to speak, or finger to keyboard?
Being good at writing takes practice. Like, being good at any medium of communication, you know, whether it's video or speaking or writing, takes practice. A lot of people confuse the medium with the message, right? And so, like, I know tons of people. It's so funny. I'll meet people like, I want to be a writer. I'm like, what do you have to say? And then they kind of look at me like, I didn't think that that was part of the job, which it doesn't have to be. You can just be some content mill schmuck at HuffPost and have nothing to say, you know, and that's fine. Then you're a writer, I guess. But for me, writing took time. But like the reason my writing does well is not because I'm a great writer. Yeah, I'm a good writer. I'm skilled at it, you know, whatever. But there are writers that people read because their sentences are beautiful. I'm not one of those. Like, the reason people read my stuff is because I tell the truth, or at least I tell my truth as I see it, right? Like, I have no monopoly on truth, but, and people will always, always, always stop and listen to people who are speaking truth.
Yeah. It's almost as though you're really not wordsmithing as much as you are writing with kind of like a bold authenticity, I guess is the best way I could describe it. And
authenticity and clarity.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people think they're being real authentic, and they might be, but 40 pages in, I don't know what the hell they're trying to say. Mm-hmm. It's just nonsense.
Yeah.
I'm very clear.
Yeah, clear and to the point. You know, I think it was Mark Twain who wrote a letter to his friend and said, my apologies, if I had more time, this letter would have been shorter. something along those lines.
Yep.
Yeah. And so for you, what's the actual process look like? Like I know that you work on some books, you work on some blog posts. You actually had a really fantastic one about prepping called Doomer Optimism that I actually want to ask you a few questions about later on. But do you wake up in the morning and just begin writing, or what's it actually look like for you in terms of your process?
My normal process, well, that used to be how it went. And then I had kids. And so, so now I wake up in the morning and I deal with my kids. Then kids go to school, maybe 8-ish. And so then normally I'll take maybe half an hour, like, you know, get all the nonsense, you know, like kind of off my plate, whatever.
Drip your springs and all that good stuff.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Drip the springs. And then if I have something to write that day, then usually I try and do it in the morning. But dude, Ben, God, like if I'm writing my 8:30 or 9, I start and then I'm done by noon. You know, like in my experience, I almost never have more than 3 hours of good writing. Sometimes four, if it's like something I'm really into and I got a lot of energy behind, but I really don't have more than about 3 hours of creative writing type work in a day in me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's Cal Newport who in Deep Work mentioned that it's somewhere right around the 3 to 4 hour time range that a human being just kind of poops out in terms of attention span and focus on a deep project.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's tough to do more without a lot of stimulants or a lot of energy or a lot of urgency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a dedicated workspace that you go to write, or do you just kind of like huff your laptop anywhere, coffee shop, wherever you happen to be, and just write?
The older I get, the more I need a dedicated space, you know? And so, like I'm at my house in Tennessee now, so it's this room, which is kind of like the office workroom. And then at my ranch in Dripping Springs, I don't have a dedicated space yet because we just moved in and we rehabbed everything. And it's kind of hellish.
Why do you have a house in Tennessee?
You don't have a vacation house?
Oh. Oh, is this your vacation house? I'm still working. I'm still working. I'll get there eventually. I have a tree fort right now, Tucker, about 100 yards out from my office.
No, God's honest truth, man, is because, look, we live in Texas for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of good things about Texas. Texas is the worst place on earth to be in the summer. Like, it is Africa hot in the summer and dry and horrible. Like, I'm not about to spend 3 months like July, August, or June, July, August in Texas, only if I hate myself.
So it's kind of like the opposite of a winter home. You have a summer home.
Yeah, exactly. And we come here for like Christmas and stuff like that, you know. It's just like because our house is awesome. It's like kind of in the middle of nowhere, right on the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And so, like, I mean, really, it's like right at the bottom of the hill is trailhead of the mountain, I guess.
Oh, wow.
Trailhead start and all that. So it's like, it's a really cool sort of place. And so my wife and I decided, like, instead of going lots of different places every year, you know, for vacation, especially after COVID, we bought this house about 6 months after COVID kind of started. Cause we're like, all right, well, clearly we're not going to be traveling the world, you know, doing a lot of that stuff. But where do we want to go? And we're like, we want a house in the mountains. So we got one.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. Well, in my defense, I actually am building a little cottage over in Idaho right now. And so I'll eventually
Wait,
have
so your vacation house is like 2 hours from your regular house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Honestly, like our family goes to Moscow a lot, Idaho, because we have some family there and we love it. And we're like, oh, I don't know. Why don't we have a place we could actually stay at down here rather than crashing in grandma's living room? So, yeah. So we're building a little house down there. But we might actually move to Idaho, but we'll see. That's a chat for another day. But, you know, for you right now, you know, we're talking about your writing style. And I know that you ran Scribe Media for a long time, which, you know, long story short, I'm describe your own business for you, Tucker, was a company that wrote books for people and also had this unique method of interviewing people via audio with a great team of editors and then producing a book for them. Is that a pretty good job at your 30-second elevator pitch?
Yeah, a book writing and publishing company. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're not doing that anymore.
Nope. I mean, the company still exists. And it's doing great. It's got a badass CEO, executive team. I just don't do anything with them.
What are you doing now?
podcast with some jerk I know from
not right now, but at this stage in your life, what makes you excited at this stage in your life, Tucker?
I ran Scribe for like 2.5 years, then hired the CEO, who was badass, and then left. Probably took longer than I needed to, but left after a total of 7 years, I think, 6.5 years. I'm really good at starting things and getting things to a certain point. Once things are mature and kind of have their own momentum, usually I'm not the dude, right? It's not my thing. What's funny is I'm in this weird in-between period, right? So I wrote all those books, sold all those copies, started a company helping people do that. That's over. And then it happened to coincide with the birth of my fourth kid, Cardinal. She was born like 3 weeks ago. And my wife said, I promised my wife I would not like do it. Oh, thank you. I promised my wife I would not do anything or start anything new for at least 3 months after she's born. Right. So like April, May or so, if I want to start something new, if something's there, I can. But like, honestly, right now, Ben, I'm just taking time and space. I guess the thing I'm working, we just moved on to our ranch, and the ranch is, we got there in October. It's pretty nice. But like, it's not ready. It's not really prepared. And so there's all the million things you have to do. I mean, you have property, we're not as out in the boondocks as you are, but we're pretty far out, I had to buy literally a whole carpenter's workshop, man, because there's just so much stuff to do. I'm not about to keep a carpenter on staff. And it's like, good luck if you can get one out there every 2 weeks, right? So now I'm like, I know what a miter saw is.
Wait. Hold on, dude. Are you poor? Are you poor? You don't have a carpenter on staff?
I am one of those poors now. Yes.
Jeez, you're one of those people.
I turned it back on me, right? I have to actually cut some of my own wood. building cool stuff. Like, obviously, we're building guest house and stuff. I'm not doing any of that. Like, those are real professionals. But just like, there's a million things around the ranch that like need to do, animals, whatever. Like, I built all the chicken runs, that kind of stuff, right? Dude, YouTube's amazing for that. So, building all that stuff out, that's a lot of work. And I'm new to it too. So, like, if I was a good carpenter, it'd be like an hour a day at most. I'm not a good carpenter. I'm an amateur. So it's like 6 hours a day for me if I'm doing a project instead of 1 hour, because I don't know what I'm doing, right? So that's mainly getting, I set everything else up, setting solar, rainwater capture, getting the animals on the land, setting everything sort of up in a really good way. It just takes a lot of time. It's the first time I've really done it. Not counting when I was a kid and like worked on a farm, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of this, this book, called The Quest for the Simple Life, or the Quest of the Simple Life, old book. Guy named William Dawson wrote it. And there's actually a great summary of the book online, the website Slow, SLOWW.co. They do really great book summaries and lessons and courses based on books. But this Quest of the Simple Life is just basically about a guy who transitioned from life as a clerk in London out to the country and downsized and downshifted and engaged in more, simple living, as the title alludes to, but discovered a great deal of satisfaction in doing actual work with his hands and learning a lot of the things that you're talking about right now, like how to raise chickens, how to chop wood, how to get water from point A to point B. And there's something about that type of work that's
because it's meaningful.
Yeah,
because
it's exhilarating.
Pushing paper is always, always bullshit. Mm-hmm. Always. And so when you actually raise chickens, that actually means something.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually unquestionably productive. You can tell yourself a story about paper pushing that might be true about how it's a necessary part of something else that's productive, but that it's never in and of itself a productive activity. It is at best a facilitation of a productive activity. I know I sound like Karl Marx, which is because I'm the opposite of a communist, but there's a lot of truth to that critique, right? It is true. Yeah. Like, I built, you probably don't know what these are, but for my first carpentry thing, I built a VTAC shooting barrier, which are like fairly simple things to do carpentry wise. But like, I was so excited and so impressed with myself and so like proud of myself, even though I know objectively it's like a week one, like beginning carpentry, like thing, like a skill, you know, like it's like the mm-hmm. first thing you work on to just to teach you. Here's how, like, it's a good thing. Like if you want to learn how to use a jigsaw and a circular saw and whatever, it's like, it's a good, simple way to practice all that, which is exactly what it was for me. I was so legit proud of, like, I was texting pictures of it to my friends, being like, look what I built. And they're like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
You know, like, but I'm seriously proud of myself, almost to the point where I was mildly embarrassed at how proud I was of something so simple. And I was like, oh, of course, because it's like a real thing that actually matters. It's not, not that I haven't, most of the stuff I do does matter, but it's just like so much of modern life is quite honestly meaningless nonsense.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, they don't realize that most folks are really wired up to be, from a creator standpoint, either craftspeople or artists, right? And those are those are two of the most fulfilling things that one can put their hands to, building a chicken coop or painting with watercolor. There's and he actually, the Dawson guy who I mentioned on that Quest of a Simple Life book, he gets into how there's a very small number of people who are business geniuses who are like, for them, their adventure, their crusade, their romance, their epic sense of meaning really is, to a certain extent, pushing papers, or more specifically, like making deals, you know, running politics, studying economics, just making the city run, so to speak. But that's not actually what makes most people happy when it comes to the work we put our hands to. For most people, it's like creating via crafting or artistry or something that actually results in you being able to, you know, hold something up to the camera and say, hey, look, I made this, you know, not necessarily so that people can see it, but just for the joy of making it and creating it and doing your art.
Yep, exactly. No, I've spent most of my adult life creating things and writing and all that stuff. Beautiful. I love it. I'm not trying to compare better or worse, but it is definitely something fundamentally different to create something physical with your hands. Again, not better or worse, right? They're just different. And they're both meaningful in very different ways. But it's funny. Like, I have hardly written at all since I got to my ranch. And like, I could tell myself the stories because I'm busy with the ranch stuff. That's BS. If I wanted to make time, I would make time. It's just because, honestly, like, I had no idea how fun it was to chop wood. Right? Because, like, when I was younger, I had to chop wood as, like, a chore. And I hated it. And now I'm like, well, first off, I have a much better splitting maul and all that kind of stuff. But like, I'm doing it for my family and for myself. And number one, and number two, I see it for what it is or it can be, which is a fantastic workout as well, right? And so like, it's actually a lot of fun. Now, if I had to do it 8 hours a day every day, I'd probably hate it.
Someone give me a book to write.
Yeah. Right? When I'm like, okay, I'm going to chop wood for an hour today because I feel like it. And then like, you know, I chop like whatever, a half a cord of wood or something. It's like, oh wow, that's super fun. And it's productive. Like I actually have wood now we can burn in the house.
Yeah, I agree. And it's also the perfect antidote for a married man who's also, you know, bringing new babies into the world. That whole idea that your testosterone will decrease, almost as though the wandering hormone tends to naturally decrease from an ancestral or evolutionary standpoint in married men. Yet at the same time, doing meaningful physical work with one's hands, and in particular, and specifically, this has even been looked at in research, chopping wood to increase your testosterone is the perfect way to keep yourself put together from an endocrine system standpoint as well. Yeah. Chopping wood actually increases.
Chopping wood increases testosterone.
Yes, there have. Chopping wood increases testosterone. I don't know if they also studied, I suppose carrying water would be the other one. But I mean, it's not surprising, right? It's an explosive, powerful activity. And we know anything like that. You could probably be out in your yard, you know, with unchopped wood doing barbell snatches and see a similar increase in testosterone. But yeah, that's a general idea. Although I suspect that if you were to compare something like, well, let's just say barbell snatches versus chopping wood, and this is getting a little bit theoretical, you'd probably see a greater increase in testosterone from chopping wood, because that's a meaningful preparatory activity that, especially for a dude, makes you feel like you're bringing home the bacon, so to speak.
I would bet on that result too. Because think of it, like, if I had to go to a CrossFit workout and like take a whatever they're called, the little mace things, and hit a tire with it, which is essentially the exact same movement, I'd be like, okay, whatever, right? But like chopping wood, right? It's such a primal activity, and it's unforgiving. You know, like, you don't hit it square on, then like you got problems, right? And it's not super dangerous, but it's dangerous enough. You can't like be on your phone when you're doing it, right? Like you're swinging an 8-pound maul. Like, that's a serious weapon. Like, that will mess you up. Like, I chop wood with, you know, steel toe boots, because I never hit my shoe, but God forbid, I don't feel like losing toes, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's living a real life, like a life connected to reality and to nature, I should say.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full-spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam, B-A-M, Beam Mineral Supplements, because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
That part of this, really, you know, the whole chopping wood and having a ranch out in Texas component, you know, I would imagine if you could, I suppose, rewind 2 or 3 years, that maybe you wouldn't have foreseen yourself doing that. But, you know, in a few of the essays that you wrote about what you called doomer optimism, you kind of get into that progression for you, that path for you, yeah, so to speak, you know, from pre-COVID to where you are right now. And I'd love to actually hear a little bit of that from you, how you actually got to the point where you were chopping wood in the backyard, and where you're at right now in terms of where you see the world going. That's a big question, but we got time. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, to be clear, there's kind of two themes, right? And they don't have to connect, but they do. So I was chopping wood in the backyard in my Tennessee house, kind of like, which we bought after COVID, but right after. So like chopping wood is just about connecting with yourself, with nature, the things that make you human, right? And I've done more and more of that over the last 2 years, definitely. But what I wrote about in the Doomer Optimism article, honestly, man, it's just like, if you've been awake and alive the past 2 years, you've seen, oh, wow, a lot of what I thought about the world wasn't true, right? Like, I think most people, at least in the West, their assumption was, yeah, for all its problems, our government is basically full of competent people trying to do the right thing, who are going to, you know, usually make the right decisions. And we all want the best, even if, you know, maybe we disagree on the path. Okay, well, I think that's clearly not true, right? Do some people like that in government exist? Of course, but they're the minority now and they're not in power. And it's obvious, if you've been paying attention at all, that things are changing very rapidly in this world, and in ways that honestly, like, are unpredictable at this point. I mean, dude, when I wrote the Doomer Optimism piece, Russia had not invaded Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It's so funny, man. I wrote that piece. So basically, let me explain to your audience that Doomer Optimism is, you know, like most people, either gloom and doom or everything's mm-hmm. great, right? And I don't think either of those positions are realistic or correct. So doomer optimism is a combination of the two ideas. It's basically the recognition of the shit's going to hit the fan, and is hitting the fan now, and is going to hit it worse. But also the belief that if you do your work, if we do our work, and if you do your work, things are going to end up okay, right? Mm-hmm. So like look around or pay attention to historical cycles. We are going into a major period of chaos, right? Like the piece I wrote was, I think it came out like Christmas, like right after Christmas, right? And it's so funny. I wrote that. And I'm like, guys, like if you think the last 2 years are things are going back to normal, or just that's it, you know, things are a little bit more chaotic, but not much. I'm like, you're a fool. And then the precursor potentially to World War III starts, right? Like I didn't plan this at all. It's so funny because so many people are like, this is nonsense, and what are you talking about? The world's not getting more chaotic, and all those idiots have Ukraine flags in their avatars now, by the way. What I said was that you know, as I, you know, you saw COVID, right, hit. I watched all the videos everyone else did. If we're going to talk about the progression, I'm like, oh, this seems like it might be a bad thing. People are dropping dead in the street in China. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should wear masks and lock down. That was in March.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was right there with you, by the way. Totally.
Like, you can look at my Twitter feed. I'm like, they shouldn't have South by this year, blah, blah, blah. Like, right. I was one of those.
Yeah, I had a freaking like pallet of N95 face masks. And I, you know, we have a quarter mile long driveway. I would walk down the driveway with the spray bottle. I forget which antiviral solution I had packaged up in the spray bottle, open the mailbox, spray each piece of mail individually, and then bring my mail back up the driveway so that it was safe for the family when I got the mail home. That was when COVID first came out.
Right, right. Because, like, I mean, listen, if it was like a smallpox, like a weaponized smallpox, what you did made sense, right? Which we didn't know for a few weeks.
Right.
And then April comes along and I'm like, okay, we still don't really know what COVID is, but this response does not look like anything that makes sense. In the long history of humans dealing with infectious disease and pandemics and plagues, nothing anyone's doing is making sense. And they're fucking lying. A bunch of people are lying. And then May hit and I'm like, okay, this is just bullshit. Like, and by May 2020, I was back in the gym doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu. You know, like, because like, my instructor's Brazilian. He's like, this is stupid. I'm like, I know. So we just kind of secretly went back and started. And I'm like, okay, this is all nonsense. And then June comes along and worst George Floyd video, horrible, gut-wrenching, heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. People take to the streets upset, which I understand, right? Like, I get it. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no. We're going to pause COVID for a while. Racial justice is more important. It's like, okay, so clearly you're all a bunch of lying bullshitters, right? Because like, yeah, I'm with you. If you're going to say people need to go protest, cool. Don't pretend that it is not going to create COVID issues. Just stop lying. And I'm like, okay, let's. And then it just got worse and worse and worse, man. So we still don't know what happened with that election. It seems weird. Who knows, right? And the way the vaccines were played, I mean, come on, man. Like as soon as Trump loses, all of a sudden the vaccines are coming out. And like, this is when they were ready, like 2 weeks earlier. And I'm like, this is such bullshit. Yeah, but okay, those are all small, low-level people.
And that's 1 year. That's basically like spring of 2020 up through the end of 2020. You've got the emergence of COVID, the hype, George Floyd, the vaccine, some of the general illogical activities going on behind it all. But question for you, and then of course I'd love to get into 2021 and your progression here of where you're at mentally. Were you thinking at that time in 2020 that this could have been some kind of like a coordinated what do you call it, a psyops type of thing, or is this just a whole bunch of people being stupid people?
So it's funny. So many people, their argument against high-level conspiracy theories or conspiracies is that most things can be chalked up to stupidity and incompetence. And they're right. It's true. The vast majority of the time. Right? And it's probably true all the time at low levels of government.
Right. The stereotypical, like, there's nobody smart enough to actually pull this off. There's no Mr. What do you call him? Smithers or whatever from The Simpsons, like, sitting up in a boardroom, putting his hands together.
My default is that position is correct. The problem with conspiracy type shit is that so many of the people who push that stuff, like, they'll be right about 20% of what they're talking about. And then the other 80%, they're like, we never went to the moon and the Chinese control the weather. And I'm like, oh, stop it. Like, just stop. Right.
Yeah.
Take Alex Jones. Alex Jones was banging the drum about Jeffrey Epstein for 15 years. Turns out he was right. Mm-hmm. He was exactly right.
Yeah.
Totally right. But then Alex Jones is also saying school shootings are false flags. I'm like, oh, stop it, dude.
It's a dent to credibility.
I get that, right? In 2020, I'm like, man, this seems weird, but it did not reach the level for me of like, okay, there's some sort of group of high-level people coordinating stuff. No, not in 2020. The moment when I thought something was way off was January 6th.
Right? Capitol building.
That was when the drunken idiot rioters were let into the Capitol building. There's now released video of this. It depends actually which entrance. Some entrances the cops let people in, others they tried to blockade. The whole thing was chaos. I watched what happened. I saw the pictures. I saw the video. I saw like live feeds. And then I saw how the media framed it. Immediately, the entire media coalesced on a very, very specific term and frame, insurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, wow, hold on. I know media. Like right now, what's going on in Ukraine? I don't really know war. I don't know Eastern European politics that well. I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert on what's going on, but I know media. And so like as soon as the Ukrainian-Russian thing, the Russian invasion happened, I knew immediately The media immediately coalesced, just like January 6th, they immediately coalesced on a narrative. All of them at once immediately coalesced on a narrative. And whenever that happens in media, you know for a fact, it doesn't mean like some, you know, like some, you know, shady a Dr. Evil character has told them all what to do, but you know there's a level of coordination. By the way, like, you feel, they don't coordinate. Do you know, okay, so Ezra Klein and that whole group at Vox,
okay,
before Obama's second term, they had a Slack group, or it might have been a different, it might, whatever, but they had like a, like all of this, the very leftist media. We're all on from all different outlets. We're literally all on a Slack channel coordinating how they were going to cover Obama, which, like, I know Barack, like, I like Barack. That's bullshit.
You mean like the heads of various media organizations, like Fox, NBC, CBS, absolutely. That they all have this Slack channel.
Absolutely. Like, this is not even it's not like that's not a conspiracy. This is an admitted thing. I know how media works. And I know narrative, and I know whenever everyone in the media is trying to convince you of something, you know for a fact it's a lie, always. Mm-hmm. Now, the opposite may not be true, right? So like in Ukraine right now, oh, Ukrainian heroes, like all of the hero stories that came out the first week are all bullshit. No ghost to Kiev, you know, like the soldiers got captured, they surrender, like all of the stories are bullshit, right?
Yeah.
But like, so like, you know, the Ukrainians are not, and I mean the Ukrainian government, not the people. The Ukrainian government's not the good guys. It doesn't mean Putin's a good guy. He's a fucking tyrant too, who kills his own people. Like, they can both be bad actors, right? Mm-hmm. Just because the media's lying doesn't mean the opposite is true. It means there's a reason why everyone wants you to believe the same thing at once. And that is never, ever a good reason for you. It happened kind of in COVID, but it was kind of weird how it happened. And it wasn't that coalesced and that immediate. January 6th, it was immediate. It was immediate and uniform. And that's when I just got this feeling, man. It's like, you know, sometimes you see something and before you can intellectually process it, you know what it is, like on a deep intuitive level. I just knew. I knew. The only way I can frame it is I knew the American, and I don't necessarily mean this literally, but I knew America had fallen. Like the idea of America and the concept of America.
The idea of a republic.
The idea of a free republic, elected officials, basically good actors. Something was rotten to the core.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm not going to pretend like I know all the details and facts. And if I really knew everything that was going on, I'd either be on the inside or dead, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But like, I don't. But I you don't have to know. It's sort of like, if you're walking into a restaurant, a beautiful looking restaurant, you see a roach on the floor, you know, don't eat there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You don't have to know anything else. You can tell yourself a story. Okay, I'll just clean my food. Man, you see a roach on the outside. I grew up in restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
If you see a roach, there's 10,000 you don't see. It's not, you know, there's not 10, not 100, 10,000 for every, maybe you could say maybe 100 rats, maybe if you're lucky. No, dude, and the entire, I mean, just like, God, the whole thing about January 6th is such, it's so brazen, and it's so obvious, and it's such a transparent lie. And it's not like I'm trying to defend those people. A bunch of Trump idiots, like they're just the opposite of the woke. They're just the other side, right? Like, I can't stand either side. Like, the MAGA extremists are no different than the woke. They just picked a different side. Right. And those morons were rioters and should not have been there and were acting like idiots. And yeah, they should have been arrested at the time, right? But no, of course they shouldn't still be in jail and sedition and treason to overthrow the government with what? None of them were armed. What the hell are they going to do? They're going to take the gavel and now they run the country? Shut up.
Yeah.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
It's transparently ridiculous, which is, by the way, one of the hallmarks of propaganda. It's so stupid and so dumb that to believe it, you have to deny your own reality.
Yeah.
I mean, what's like the defining quote in 1984? Believe the party, not your lying eyes or something, right? So that happened. And then it took me honestly a few days to emotionally process, right? Because up to that point, I'm like, okay, things might be broken, but I mean, come on, it's still America.
Right.
At that point, I knew. Right. And at the probably, you probably get people listening. This guy's lost his mind. Okay, cool. We're going to see. We're going to see. Mm-hmm. Right. And so at that point, then I got really serious. It's like, okay, baby. Like my wife and I always, we want to be on land. Like, in fact, you and your family were like a lot of ways a model for us. Like, we kind of want to do what Ben's doing, except not quite so extreme. Right? Just dial it back.
Where were you guys living at that point?
In Austin.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And so we knew we wanted to stay in Texas. Politically, the only two places, in my opinion, to be in America, there's maybe three places, Idaho, Texas, and Florida. Mm-hmm. And I think there's really bad arguments for Idaho and Florida. I think Texas really, in my opinion, is the only place to be in America. You can make a legit argument for about five or six other states, but I think Texas is the best. So we knew we were going to stay in the state.
At least it's the most likely to secede and probably has the highest number of citizens well equipped to defend themselves.
So here, Ben, you got to stick with me because most people don't under. Once I saw January 6th, it's like my brain flipped and I understood like we, all of us in America have grown up in the bosom of probably the safest, most abundant period in the history of the world. We don't have any, if you're truly American, you don't have any fucking idea what it means to be literally afraid for your life on a daily basis, to be truly insecure about life, liberty, property, right? Like you don't understand any of that. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the only reason I have an inkling of that is because I've spent so much time overseas. And so like you spend enough time in places like India or Africa or Egypt, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, okay. Like, wow, the world's very different, right?
Yeah.
And so like, I'm not pretending like I understand what it's like to be an African, but I do understand what it's like to be an American in Africa. And so like, when I saw that, right, and I saw, okay, if I'm right, if the American empire truly has fallen, if it's rotted from the inside, let's say, right, then what that, and we're going into a period of extreme chaos. This is a year ago, right? If we're going into a period of extreme chaos, then all of these things that people take for granted are no longer going to be true, right? So like, I need to start thinking about being really serious, like what do we do when everything you rely on doesn't work? Meaning like, not only do the cops not show up, they don't exist. Like I'm just saying in extreme cases. Mm-hmm. What do you do when there's no gas? What do you do when there's no electricity? What do you do when there's no water? What do you do when there's no food in the grocery store?
Yeah, what do you do if you have to be a sovereign man and responsible for everything that you actually need? What would that actually look like?
No one alive in America has had to really actually understand what it means to be sovereign.
There's a quick subtle nuance there, of course. Like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tucker, but when you and I throw on word like sovereign, we're not saying that you should be able to deceive yourself that you can survive in a completely independent lone wolf operative scenario. Dependence and community is enormously important, more important actually, I think now more than ever. But at the same time, even if it means interdependence and community, doing that without necessarily having to be reliant upon an external source like the government to care for you or protect you or defend you is what you're getting at.
Yeah, 100%. Like most people confuse freedom and sovereignty, and most people's concept of freedom is very juvenile, right? Like I get to do whatever I want. Okay, mm-hmm. fine. If you combine freedom and responsibility, very roughly, I'm talking about, that's really what sovereignty is, mm-hmm. right? Assuming it's chosen responsibility. And then on top of that, no, humans, let me keep going on this because I'm going to get, you're exactly right. Community and sovereignty go hand in hand, right? Like I'm not trying to go live off grid. That doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Like that's nonsense, right? The people who survive chaos are people who are in groups, mm-hmm. effective, tight-knit groups, right? That have skills, that are in good places, good positions, good leadership. Those are the people who survive chaos, not individual, not lone wolf Rambos. That's just, that's a nonsense American movie idea from the 80s. Right. So anyway, so I honestly kind of panicked a little bit last January. And then I went and found, you know, some, I got a friend who was in Chechnya during the original sort of Chechen revolution. I got a couple of friends who came over from Serbia and Croatia. And then I got a lot of friends in the military, specifically Green Berets. And their job basically is to start revolutions or end them, right? They go into chaotic places and train people how to deal with chaos. That's what they do, right? And so I talked to all of them, as many as I could. And man, the thing that blew my mind, the number one thing they all told me is exactly what you just said, Ben, community. They're like, dude, you like, get rid of the idea. Because most people, you know, they think of like prepping, right? Like, oh, I'll build a bunker and I'll go hide for a while. That's not going to work. You're not going to make it. That's not like, that is an idea that is a relic of the Cold War nuclear sort of Holocaust, right? Maybe that was a relevant preparation method for a nuclear Holocaust. Although I think even then it wasn't that great, but it was better than nothing, let's say, right? But for what's coming, for a world of let's say broken supply chains, network, like complete cutting off of networks, like what's happening to Russia right now, of all kinds of tyranny, you've got to be in a group and a good one. Doesn't have to be big, but you sovereignty and community go hand in hand for humans.
Right?
I mean, maybe there's other animals like great white sharks. It doesn't go together. Humans, it does. And so that's, they all said that. And then the like, number one was community. Number two that they all talked about was like, you need to start thinking on a really primal level about resources. Like, where do you get your water?
Yeah.
Where do you get your food? Where do you get your energy? Can you keep it when a gang of men with guns comes to take it? Not the sheriffs to arrest you for property tax, but like in, this is things we've never had to think about in America ever. Right. And even right now, today, in most places in America, I would argue we don't have to think about this right now today. Right. But if you want, you want to understand what America can be like, if all of these very fragile global systems that hold us together don't work, think about what New Orleans was like after Katrina, right? Or what Texas was like last February.
When it snowed.
During the winter apocalypse.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. Dude, I'm not kidding. Two things. It's so funny. January 6th happens, and then the winter apocalypse hit, right? And I was in, I live in Texas. And so we were, I thought at that point I was kind of ready. And then the winter apocalypse hit, and I'm like, oh, man. I was more ready than 95% of people, and I would have fucking died after 2 weeks. I was screwed. I was not ready. And I, like, I had a freezer full of, I had 600 pounds of meat, and I had, like, I, you know, guns out, ammo out the ass and all this stuff. And I still, like, without, you know, going too deep into detail, I realized I was not even in the realm of being ready. And so it's like, oh, man. And you know why? Because I wasn't sovereign. I didn't own and control my water source. I didn't own and control my power source. I had backup food, but I had non-redundant power supplies. And I, like, I had not much food. There were all kinds of gaps I had, right? Like, we didn't have any toilet paper, whatever. Like, there 20 things or 50 things, you know, that we just didn't have backups on or supplies on or ways to get them, right? There were all these things. And so that's really when I started diving in with the people I know who have lived through chaos and survived it and thrived it. And like, I'm like, all right, we need to go get on land, good land that can support agriculture and can support animals, that has its own water, right? And that where we can have multiple backup power supplies, right? Now, I'm not living off grid, man. No one lives off grid. That's nonsense. In the world we live in, off grid doesn't, you think you're off grid. What are you going to do when your power coupler fries for your solar? Oh, you realize you're not off grid. You're on China's grid, right? So I understand I'm not off grid. No one's off grid, but I'm in Dripping Springs is one of those weird places that just kind of like coalesced, and me and like 30 other people like you and I, you don't, you're not there, but people like us are there. And it was already, the reason I picked it and a bunch of us picked it is because they already had a large ranching and ex-military contingent, right? So, like, I'm not going to go too deep into that community. Dripping Springs is a great place to be. Like, mm-hmm. it is. There's a reason that the land out there is going for well over $100,000 an acre, and it's crap
wow.
land. Like, it's wow. growing stuff or whatever.
Jeez, $100,000 an acre?
$100,000 an acre, an hour outside of Austin.
I'm on 9 acres, and I paid $90,000 for 9 acres. And
you have abundant land. It's in Washington. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. Land in Idaho is getting a little bit more expensive, but I've got 12 acres over there, and I guarantee I didn't pay anywhere close to $100,000 an acre on that. But yeah, it's regardless what you're getting at is this idea that there are multiple factors that need to be taken into consideration, multiple things that need to be covered. And we could talk about, about the threat of hyperinflation and what's actually going to happen until we're blue in the face. But I really want to focus on some of the more practical aspects of, let's assume that you need to be ready for something either way. What are some of the main things that you cover? So, you mentioned that your source of power, your source of water, and your source of food are all important, but boots on the ground or axe in the hand, so to speak, what are some of the other main things that you have done, or some of the main specific things that you've done in those sectors, food, water, and electricity, that you just think people should freaking know?
There's 5 planks: defense, okay. water, food, power, community. So I'll go through some basic parts of each one. Defense is number one. And the reason I didn't think defense was that important until literally one of the SF guys goes, I'm like, oh, I got this and this and, all my supplies and not just like preppings, like dried foods, fine. But like, I want chickens, not dried food. Like, I want stuff that can produce assets, right? And he's like, this is all cool. He goes, so what you've just done is all the work I need to do, because I'm going to get 10 of my buddies and come take it. And I was like, oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, which is why defense and community are often heavily intertwined, right? Like, because right. even if I have the most badass guns on earth, I'm not beating to him and even 3 of his buddies. I'm done. I'm out, right? They got me. And so, like, all right. So for defense, pre-COVID, I had a hunting rifle and a pistol. And I think my wife had a shotgun. Mm-hmm. Now I have an arsenal. Like, I went a little overboard with guns, but I have some badass assault weapons and I have tons of training on how to use them. A lot of ammo. Like, I'm not going to tell you how much. It's so much. It's ridiculous, dude. Like, it's insane. I bought a lot. I bought ammo by the pallet. Anyway, which I went a little crazy there. Like, I'm not. And so, but it's not just the gear, man. Like, I've burned through sheepdog responses courses. That's Tim Kennedy's training thing. I've trained with Clay Martin.
Did you and your wife both take the sheepdog response?
Yes. My wife. And then also she hasn't done it yet, but I've got my wife. Once she recovers from the baby, I'm going to get her trained in long distance shooting. Like, I'm an mm-hmm. okay shot at distance. But she's actually a really good shooter. Like, with a carbine, she's a badass. Like, I'll put mm-hmm. her right next to me. I know. But, like, I want her, sniping. Like, mm-hmm. so she's actually, like, we've got her set up with, like, it's insane. The person who's going to be training her. It's so cool. And so not just that hand-to-hand. Like, I mean, there's so many levels of defense. What's your car situation? What's this? What's that? So, like, the guy who really set me up with defense, I actually hired him as a consultant. His name is Clay Martin. He wrote the book Concrete Jungle and Prairie Fire. He's an ex-Green Berets, 20 years in Special Forces. Prairie Fire is basically a book about what's going to happen when the shit hits the fan in America. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing book, man. I read that book and I about vomited at a couple sections.
Is that a new book?
It's pretty new. I think it's only been out about a year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah, dude, Ben, you should read you should actually have Clay on your on your podcast. I can connect you to him. He's like a good friend of mine now.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah, let's do that later on.
Okay, cool. So anyway, I got really set up, not just buying guns and sitting them on a shelf. Like, I know how to use a gun, right? I can plink some metal target 10 feet away. No, like a lot of stress training, I hesitate to call it combat training, but it's the step below combat training. Serious, engaged firefight self-defense training. Right? Hand-to-hand combat with knives, guns, things like that. Like, how do you use a gun when someone attacks you? How do you use a knife when you get a... How do you defend against these things? I mean, Grant, mm-hmm. I've been doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for years. So like I'm a brown belt in Jiu-Jitsu. So like I'm like, that was an area I was already pretty comfortable, but I realized I didn't really actually know what the hell I was talking about. And I really wasn't ready.
Right. Or what happens when you're rolling and someone actually has a knife tucked into their belt loop or, or a gun stashed in their sock. Like, cause I've done that sheepdog course and it's a lot different to roll when you're at the same time, keeping your one eye open for someone's weapon and your other eye on their hand. Like it's a whole new variable.
It's so crazy you bring that up. Right. Cause I went to the sheepdog course. At that point, I was a purple belt. Right. And I know Tim. Like, he rolls at my gym with me. Like, I know him really well. And so I'm like, I walk in, I know all the instructors cause I've rolled with them. Half of them I've submitted in jujitsu. And so like, I'm like, okay, I'm basically like an instructor for the hand to hand part. And for the first day, I kind of was like, I would roll with the women and kind of help them through their stuff. And when I find some dude, I just smash him and it was super fun. And then the next day, they added knives. And those same women that I was like, going 10% with because I'm not trying to hurt them were fucking my world up for like mm-hmm. 15 minutes or half an hour. Like old ladies like were stabbing me in the liver. And I'm like, dude, it was actually super shocking because I realized if I had gone before that, if I had gone into combat or if I had a fight, just a street fight with some schmo and he had a knife, I was going to die.
Right.
And I would have thought I was going to be fine.
Right. Not because you suck, but simply because you're not yet unconsciously competent in that scenario.
Right. They have no chance against me, unarmed. But old women with knives were, at that point, were killing me. And dude, it was such a crazy reframe. Because like I literally realized, man, if I had gotten into a knife fight on the street the morning before, I would have died because I would have been... It's not that I couldn't handle it. After about half an hour, I got the skills and then I integrated them with jiu-jitsu and I was like, I was solid with defending against a knife. But like, I didn't know, right? Is the unknown unknowns are the ones that kill you. And so like, that was one of those where it was like, oh my God. Like, I sat in my truck afterwards and I'm like, oh my God, I thought I was a badass and I would have gotten myself killed. And so that's actually when I hired Clay to really run through all my gear and everything. And he was just like, so good, man. So, all right, defense. Then, here's the thing. A lot of people are like, what are you going to do? You're going to fight the U.S. military? I'm like, I'm not talking about secession. Although, the U.S. might break up in some way, shape, or form. No, civilians, I don't think it's a realistic scenario that civilians are going to be fighting the military in the street. But what is a very realistic scenario is the summer of 2020. In Austin, where I live, there were, Antifa was doing riots, right? They were just doing their riots. And some dude, and I know this for a fact because I train with all the SWAT cops, some dude rolled up and was handing out AK-47s to rioters. And a Lyft driver pulled around the corner and some random guy who had gotten handed an AK-47 like half an hour before, he raised his AK at the Lyft driver. Turns out the Lyft driver was an off-duty sergeant in the infantry who had his 45 right there and who'd done two tours in Iraq. He saw a dude pull an AK on him. He did what a soldier does. He pulled his gun and put two in his chest.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, like, could that happen? Hell yes, that could happen. Absolutely. In fact, that did happen. For an entire summer, there were massive, horrific pockets of violence in America, unrestrained violence in America, which we haven't seen since the 70s.
If you were to ask, like in the 1770s or whatever, any of the American patriots, these farmers prior to the American Revolution, whether they were preparing for war, or preparing for a secession, or preparing for a massive, a cataclysmic event, you probably wouldn't get a ton of yeses. They were all just basically caring for their farms, their land, preparing themselves to be able to defend themselves against anything from a bear to a raid to anything like that. But they weren't necessarily preparing for war. It sounds to me like really the mentality should be just prepare yourself to be able to be a responsible
defense.
Free sovereign individual. And defense is going to be a natural byproduct of that. Not so you can go to war, but just so you can protect your family from anything.
You can stop the people who are trying to go to war on you. I hope to God I never have to pull my gun in anger and shoot someone. Seriously. Like, I'm not... Dude, pre-COVID, I had a hunting rifle because I like to hunt, and I had a pistol, and it was, like, in a case in my closet. Right? I'm not, like, one of those dudes who was, like, buying up all this gear. I was not a tactical wannabe pre-COVID. I just wasn't, man. I liked hunting, and that was it. And I only hunted, like, once a year, and I hunted deer. Like, come on, right?
Yeah.
Post-COVID, like, you see me with a fanny pack. It's got a gun in it. I did. It's actually on a podcast. I did in person. I showed the dude. He just moved to Texas. It was hilarious. But, like, yeah, dude. Like, downtown Austin is not safe.
Yeah.
Like, not anymore, man. There's all kinds of shit. It used to be like, man, no problem.
Well, if you see me walking through Walmart, my fanny pack has fingernail clippers in it. But if you have my wife walking next to me, hers has the Glock Gen 4 rapid recoil. So just don't mess with her. I'll be able to clip your nails, though. Okay. So defense. Defense is one. You got your knife skills. You got gun skills. I'd imagine home defense, security system, just anything that would go into defense. That's the first thing to be thinking about.
Best home defense, a dog. Big dog. We have two big ones. Two big dogs. Point. Lots of other things you can do. Very little beats big dogs. Defense locked in. That's the prong I'm probably the most confident with in my life right now. Then after that's water, right? Because if you're thinking, again, this is survival, right? Thinking from a survival, in all degrees of survival. And survival first, sovereignty second. Can't go very long without water. Part of the big thing we were looking for when we were picking property was we want wells. Either we want it on rivers or creeks in Texas is good, but it's iffy. Because the way water works in Texas is super weird. And so, like, being on full year-round creeks and rivers doesn't actually always guarantee access to water. It's without getting into water rights and all that nonsense. But having a well, a good well, means you're good, right? So, like, we have a well where the water table's at, like, 400 feet and the well's dug to 700. Mm-hmm. So, like, we're good to go. And that thing just pumps water all day, all night, no problem. We are actually also installing a rainwater capture, a 30,000-gallon rainwater capture thing. Now, we're in Texas, right? Like, where you are, man, you just have a bucket, you're good with water, right? So where you are with water is a whole, I'm in Tennessee right now. Seriously, it rains 20 inches a month here, something nonsense. But we don't worry about water here.
Yeah.
Like, you don't worry about, Texas water is the most important thing. So where you are is highly dependent on how important, water's the most important to everyone, but how much focus you have to have on.
Yeah. And one subtle nuance regarding water, by the way, is don't assume that if it's a well or a spring that you're drinking clean water. I mean, I have a really great well with a good flow rate, but I also have high levels of bacterial based iron and manganese and could look like, you know, I've been eating heavy metal laden sushi for a year if I don't address that.
What do you use? Berkey filter?
Oh, for my well water? Oh, no. I have a hydrogen peroxide-based scrubbing filter for the iron that then passes through a manganese filter for the manganese. Then that goes through double block carbon filtration. And then finally, before it enters into the pipes in the house, it goes through like a structured water vortexing system to kind of restore it back to its natural vibratory frequency before it goes through all those other filters. So it's a pretty elaborate setup, but it's for a well. You know, I'm not filtering out my neighbor's birth control supplies or, you know, municipal water issues. It's literally like that nice romantic clean well in the backyard. But even those, you know, you got to test the water and make sure you have the right filtration system set up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're way ahead of me. I have Berkey filters, which those kept the British Army healthy for 130 years.
The only reason I'm ahead of you is my dad is a water filtration ninja. That's his company is water filtration system. So I just know. I can connect you with him if you want.
All right. But yes, filtration, extremely important. Cleanliness with water, obviously. Mm-hmm. So the next food, right? Okay. So we live in Texas. Not easy to grow stuff, but definitely possible as long as you're smart with water and how you do stuff. But what we decided to, my wife and I, we prioritized. As soon as we got on the land, we put cows on because, like, we bought, you know, we deep freezes, of course, like multiple huge ones, bought a full cow and a full bison, slaughtered them, put them in the freezer, bought two cows for the land, mm-hmm. right? Which it doesn't sound like much, but that's like 2 years of meat basically as they grow and mature, right? So we're pretty good on meat. then we're adding sheep and also chickens.
Yeah, you got to talk. To Jordan Rubin. Jordan Rubin. I had a fascinating discussion with him because he runs all these regenerative farms. He said that if he'd go back and do it over again, he wouldn't start with cows. He'd start with yaks and water buffalo. He said the milk, their ability to be able to care for themselves, the meat, everything is superior with those, which is interesting. If I ever get livestock,
really?
I'll probably go in for Texas? Yaks. Yeah, yaks, water buffalo, and then duck instead of chickens. Those are his recommendations.
Yeah, my wife has been talking about duck. She loves duck eggs. Yeah, so we did get red Angus, which totally, and we got only steers.
Yeah.
So like once they're weaned, so like in terms of caring for themselves, we don't need it. Like we're good to go. Red Angus they're almost as hardy as longhorns with that stuff. But hold on, who's milking a water buffalo, man? Or is he milking the yak?
I don't know. I really haven't had the opportunity yet to wrap my hand around a yak nipple. But when I do, I'll let you know.
Okay. All right. That's actually super interesting. I want to look into that. Thank you for that. All right. So dealt with protein. Then next, we're adding smaller protein. You know, sheep, chickens, ducks,
mm-hmm.
And then also then we're going to start adding this spring. We're going to put in our garden beds. Start growing stuff.
Yeah.
So like that, which on land is a lot of people are like, well, you're on, you know, a huge ranch, you 2 acres. There's actually books about, there's great ones. I can't remember what it's called. There's an amazing one about how on, I feel like it was a quarter acre. It may have been a half acre in LA. This couple figured out how to grow like 7,000 pounds of produce on a half acre in the city of Los Angeles. Yeah,
it is ridiculous, the argument against not enough space that someone might bring to the table. I have a closet in my, I mean, we have a greenhouse. We have like 8 raised garden beds and, you know, we have food just, you know, coming out the wazoo up here, just that's growing outside. But also, and this is just more of kind of like me as a curious podcaster wanting to see what's out there thing. I've got a closet next to the garage that's got enough vegetables growing in a vertical growing system. This one's called a lettuce grow, literally just bursting with vegetables that could feed my family for the entire month from a produce standpoint. And that takes up about, 2 feet wide, 8 feet high worth of space. It's nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, most people are very, very doomer about this instead of optimist. It's actually real. Once you decide, it does take some effort and a little bit of a learning curve, but not much. And once you decide to do it, it's our goal this year is 50% of our protein either comes from our land or animals I harvested. Like, and so like right now we're well over 50% because basically everything we eat at home. Is the bee, like, and the bison I harvested, I've got a bunch of, you know, of whitetail that I've shot. We got their stuff, a little bit of a hog, whatever. So like, we're not eating grocery store meat anymore. Like, unless we're out at a restaurant or something.
Right.
Which also is super, it's like, you can tell the difference, man. It's so healthy. All right. So that's food. Right. And then the next one's energy. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Energy's rough, man, because like, man, it's, dude, I don't know. Do you have a solar array?
Yeah, I've got a solar array. I live in a north facing slope that only gets adequate sunlight from, you know, like average 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. or so. So it's not harnessing a lot of energy, but it, you know, it's there, and it's basically, I've tested it multiple times. And when I shut down everything else, most of my house and the freezers and the refrigerator can all switch to that polar or that solar pretty efficiently. And I'm one of those biohackers who's nervous about dirty electricity. So I always tell everybody, make sure that you've got you can basically get a switch on the generator that when it converts from DC to AC power, it tends to generate a lot of dirty electricity. So people who are concerned about the EMF thing, you can hack that with a little solar switch. But yeah, I have solar right now. And then, municipal still coming in as well.
Yeah. So part of the reason we picked the land is because, it's serviced by an electrical co-op off a hydroelectric dam. So like everything's all right. Everything can be fucked with, but it's much harder to mess with that. Right. So so that's our service provider. And then we're installing solar But dude, finding a good provider and getting up batteries, that stuff is way harder than most people think. A lot of people have said, oh, just put in solar and you're great. No. Solar is not the answer. Like it is part of an answer. It is not the answer. And then we also have backup generators we have two backup generators because we got a lot of buildings and whatever. Each have 1,000-gallon propane tanks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing I'm on the fence about with the propane tank generator. And this is something I'm in the process of going through right now, just because I have so much wood on my land. I mean, it's basically a forest that I live in. So I'm looking into a gasification unit, which basically can convert timber or charcoal into wood gas. And then that serves as the generator, but it's basically like a generator that's fueled by wood rather than gasoline.
Well, that's cool. I live in Texas. We don't have much wood. We're not fancy like you.
but you're rich enough to have a vacation home in Tennessee, so you're good.
But notice, though, that like environment matters a lot, like where you pick, right?
Yeah.
And so I am absolutely, after living through the Texas winter apocalypse, I am absolutely convinced that energy issues, and obviously the price of gas now, of course, energy issues are going to dominate. Like there's a lot of weird stuff going on with that too, without going deep into like, cause who knows what's going on, but I don't know. Weird stuff's going on there. And then the last one's community. And this is actually probably the most important, but it's either the place you need to start. Like it's the thing that imbues through everything. Right. So we picked dripping. We could live basically anywhere we want. We picked Dripping Springs. Which I think is probably the best bet, other than if I had bought like 1,000 acres and tried to build my own town or something, which just wasn't practical in a short time frame. And I know a lot of people, actually. I know several building intentional communities, and I think me and a group are going to end up building our own town. That's 5-10 years out, right? In the short term, I need to get into a place that both has all the things I talked about, but then also around other people like me. Right. Mm-hmm. Around other people who have 10, 20, 50, 100, 200 plus acres who think in the same general sense that I do about sovereignty. And right. Dripping Springs right now has like, I sound like the Dripping Springs Chamber of Commerce, except they're super anti-development. Like everything in the area is septic because they won't approve of, they won't build a sewer. So like it limits development, which is actually pretty nice. And they won't issue building permits anymore. So like you got to kind of buy something either on unincorporated land or something that exists. But Dripping was full of ex-military and ranchers. And so it was like, oh, these are the perfect people where if you need to put your boots in the dirt, right? And whether it's either fight or grow food or support each other, these are the people.
Yeah.
Right. And so I've gotten into that community. I don't want to go too much into detail about that, like on a podcast with people I don't know, but like, it's an amazing community of people. And like, it's a really good situation. Now, you don't have to necessarily find the perfect town. Like, if you can be in a place where you've got almost any country place where you can find good people who are like you, whatever that means, right? Who have shared values, you're going to be in a pretty good situation. But the point is, people who are used to relying on themselves and their neighbors, not city people. And I used to be one, so I'm not trying to shit on them. But like, if you live in New York, it's a whole separate mindset to reality than if you live in, you know, rural Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. Oddly enough, paradoxically, it seems as though it's a little bit more of an independent lone wolf mentality in a big bustling city than it is in an isolated community where everybody knows each other's names and is able to, you know, take care of each other's banjos and chainsaws, but, you know, be able to come to each other's aid and know each other. I think that's important. I mean, you know, I think it's more from a business and a career standpoint, but I think it was Naval Ravikant who I read, you know, he wrote something like choosing the city that you live in can determine the trajectory of your life. Right. And so there is something to be said for that from a preparatory standpoint as well. I mean, that is one of the reasons also I'm looking into Idaho right now, just for that very, very reason, you know, smaller, more close-knit community in a slightly friendlier state. And so, Yeah, I agree. The community is a huge piece. And, you know, once I realized that I didn't have to be spraying down my mail when COVID first started, I literally began to throw weekly dinner parties. We would have neighbors over, friends from the local community. People would bring food potluck style. We'd all be hanging out in the living room, you know, without the masks on, just basically creating friendships and community. Because at the very back of my mind, even though part of it was I miss people after not seeing people for whatever, you know, it was like 6-8 weeks, you know, while we were kind of locked in. Part of it too was me at the back of my head thinking, you know what? I need, selfishly enough, a network of people who will take care of me when shit goes south and who I can help when.
And it's not the motherfuckers on Twitter or Facebook.
Right.
One of the big things that my buddy, I think it was my Croatian buddy, who told me, he said, dude, when the power, because, you know, like he was in the Bosnian wars and all that. He's like, when the power goes out, your only reality is like maybe 2 miles around you, at most 20 if you have a bicycle. Like that's your entire reality, and everything beyond that doesn't exist. And like at first I didn't understand what he meant, but because he told me this before I got the ranch. Once I got onto the ranch, I realized, oh damn, he's right. Like if the power went out at my ranch, cops aren't coming. And nothing against the Hayes County sheriffs, because they're great. But like, how am I going to call them? You know, like, how do I, like, if the power goes out and like there's some emergency, tree falls, whatever, right? Or like there's a big countywide thing, right? The people who are coming to help me are my neighbors.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah,
that's my reality.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, just a little thought exercise for people, because this happened to me 3 days ago, and so it's fresh on my mind. I was working. Well, here's a little mental picture visualization exercise for you. I'm working in my office with my little red light panels, stripped down, buck ass naked, doing my whole stupid biohacker thing, you know, with my laser lights up my nose and the red lights on, you know, sipping my crazy mushroom tea and working on my computer, and the power goes out, or at least the, you know, the breaker flips. So I'm standing there naked, you know, half a cup of coffee, the lights turn off, the computer shuts down. I'm staring at a blank computer screen, naked and just completely defenseless. And I'm standing there and I realize I just need to go out in the garage and reset the breaker. But I thought, okay, so let's just say it was like this for the whole day and then the week and then the month. What you gonna do? Right. And you start thinking about that. I mean, even try it. If you're at home, just shut off the power for a day and see if you can get by for a day. And you realize about 100 different things, from your refrigerator and your freezer to where the food's going to go, to the fact that you can't make a phone call, to all of the things that you just didn't even freaking think about. And it gets pretty serious. And that's one day. Or even try it between breakfast and lunch.
Yeah.
You know?
No, totally. Seriously. Dude, when the winter apocalypse hit in Texas, we were way better off than most people. Like my company at that point was like 70 or 80 people. And a bunch of them, you know, like they're the millennials who live in town in some, you know, like douche cube apartment. And they're like, you know, on Slack, like the ones who had power were on Slack, like, hey, I only have Cheetos in my apartment. Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
And then like the line at HEB is 7 hours long, or there's no food at HEB, right? Because the roads were all frozen. So like no one could get food to anyone. And so one girl actually went to HEB, stood in line for 6 hours. HEB is a grocery store. Stood in line for 6 hours, got like a tiny bag of food, like nonsense. Was walking back to her apartment, and literally some dude tried to rob her. Like tried to rob her for food. Like this is 13th century England, right? Yeah. Or like the Great Depression. And so we had 600 pounds of meat in our deep freeze. I took 200 pounds because I knew like this wasn't a long-term thing. We're going to be fine. I took 200 pounds, drove it because I had a truck, or I had a Range Rover. And like we had, I'm not kidding, 35 people walk in, some of them up to 5 miles away for like 3 pounds of meat or whatever, 5 pounds of meat, whatever it was. And like there are people still to this day. Like it's one of the reasons we always win all the best companies to work for. Like we won best company to work for in Austin, like all of Austin, the number one best company. And like six people wrote, dude, they fed me during winter apocalypse or I would have starved. And like, you can laugh about it now because, you know, it all passed after a week and whatever. But like, what happens when it doesn't?
Yeah.
What happens when it's 3 weeks?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I'm not talking about the world's going to end or anarchy. No. But what happens when the chaos is so extreme, grocery stores don't resupply for a month? I mean, how many people can make it a month?
You as a father of four kids would probably get this. And this is something that I think it'd probably fall under the community umbrella. But I think that family and education are two really important factors here. Meaning, what are you teaching kids and how are you teaching them in terms of whether they're going to be creative, free thinking, independent, and resilient young human beings who can thrive in unpredictable scenarios, or whether you've basically set them up so that they learn everything from someone else and are more of a sheeple, a lemming, and someone who just knows how to put the square peg in the square hole and the round peg in the round hole. And I think that the concept, I mean, this is like a biblical concept, right? Children are like arrows in a quiver, and literally like having an educated and resilient family, all of whom who can stick up for and care for each other. I think that's a, to me, like top of the totem pole as far as the community goes, because I think that we need to not just be preparing ourselves, but preparing our children and allowing our children to shadow us and follow us and see what we're doing as we're preparing. And I think that's incredibly important as well.
100%. I mean, like I know you do this too. I take my kids hunting with me almost every mm-hmm. time I go, right? Like yeah. my kids know where our food comes from and they're all yeah. part of it. Okay. Like with the cows came and they're all cute. They want to name them. I'm like, okay, you totally can. But you know what's going to happen, right? And they're like, yeah, of course. And so they named them Beef and Steak.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, cool. Those names will work, right? But like even chopping firewood, all this sort of stuff. They all understand that we live on a ranch and a ranch has responsibilities and that we all get to be a part of it. We don't have to, right? We get to. And that part of being sovereign, we talk about sovereignty and part of the responsibility of not, if you want to be sovereign, it comes with responsibility and it comes with things that we all have to do. And so like, I do all the cooking in my family and my daughter loves it. And so she like, I call her my little sous chef, right? Sous chef Vaughn. So she like almost every night cooks with me, right? Like, and of course she's like five and she's terrible. She like makes more mess than she helps, but eventually she's going to be good at it, you know, and like all that investment will pay it off. My son doesn't want to cook at all, but he wants to go hunt. You know, she does too, actually, but he's super or like outdoor stuff or whatever. Right. Okay, cool. Yeah. No, they're absolutely all a part of it. They understand everything we have is coming from somewhere, right? Like the days of magical America, bless its heart, I think are ending.
Yeah.
And not just saying, I think they're over and it's just a matter of time before most people realize it. And it doesn't mean we're all going to die. It doesn't mean it's chaos or anarchy or end of the world. No, it just means we're transitioning to a new phase, right? Now, this is the optimism part. Like a lot of people read my piece and like, it's all gloom and doom. What's the optimism part? Like this seems like it sucks. And it kind of ties back into what we talked about with chopping wood is when you live on land, right? And I mean any land. And you are the one doing most of the or a lot of the meaningful work to produce a lot of what you consume. Your entire reality changes. You are no longer a passive consumer. You are now a creator.
Right.
Right. And I think the narrative around blue collar labor and around farming and all this sort of stuff in our country has been the intellectuals and the artists have framed the narrative about other people. And I think a lot of those people, which God knows I was, are now becoming the farmers and the workers. People like you and I are at the tip of the spear with this. Like we're years ahead of most people, but I think this is going to come and come fast. And a lot of people are going to realize, oh, wow, I had a lot wrong about my old life. Yeah. God knows I did. Like I lived in the tallest in Austin. I could not have been more of a city type dweller. And like there are benefits to that. There's things that are cool, but ultimately that doesn't work. And I don't just mean like climate, unsustainability. Maybe that's true. I'm just talking about on a personal, emotional level. That is extractive living.
Yeah. And look, I think that folks should know, if you're listening in, you will have imposter syndrome. You will feel stupid. You will be, gosh, like I was 8 years ago, a guy who never grew up hunting out in the forest, trying to field dress a deer while holding a bloody latex glove in one hand and clutching my smartphone to watch how to field dress a deer on YouTube. And I felt stupid, but you know, at the same time, I was embracing that discomfort because I knew that I wanted to know how to prepare for myself. So if you're listening in and you're like, gosh, where do I start? And you decide you're going to go, and I'll link to them, like go read Tucker's Doomer Optimism articles. And you're going to maybe, you know, pick up the Prairie Fire book and start to educate yourself on some of this stuff. And, you know, Google your community and a local CSA or CowShare or all these things that you're going to be starting down the rabbit hole of. Understand beforehand, yeah, you're going to feel dumb. There's going to be imposter syndrome. And furthermore, don't regret having not delved into this before. Be grateful that you're listening to this podcast right now, and now you've got some momentum to start diving in, right? What's the saying, Tucker? The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago or today, right? And so if you're listening in, I mean, like it's going to be uncomfortable. But, you know, the other thing that I want to mention, and I know we're getting a little bit long in the tooth, so we'll probably end here pretty soon, is that, you know, I also, like Tucker, don't think that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Look, I am not only a Christian, but I'm what's called a post-millennial Christian. What that means is that I think that the world is getting better and better and better, and that eventually we'll have this amazing, fully restored new heaven and new earth. But there are going to be some speed bumps along the way. However, those speed bumps are sometimes what it takes to shift us into the better scenario. Yeah, maybe we're going to develop a fully decentralized cryptocurrency that operates far, far better and more efficiently and with less problematic scenarios than fiat currency. Maybe we are going to have a whole bunch of people in America and beyond who adopt an educational system that involves parents being with their children more and actually preparing their children in a far more creative and free-thinking manner. Maybe we're going to all learn how to hunt and care for the land and develop a more intimate connection with nature and with our community and with our families, with our neighbors a little bit more, right? The way I look at it is all this stuff winds up working out to make us even better. But I really want to tell you, if you're listening in right now, just freaking start, but start the way that Tucker has outlined, with an optimistic frame set. And not a frame set that you're preparing yourself for the next zombie apocalypse, which maybe if it happens, that's too bad, but you're going to be ready. And that's the way I see things, Tucker.
I mean, that's pretty optimistic. Yeah. I'm on board.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. But, you know, I obviously could talk to you for a very long time, Tucker, because you have prolifically written about a lot of these matters. And I know you are kind of in the process of getting a whole bunch of really great resources together on your blog. So folks go to tuckermax.com. You guys can check out Tucker's essays on Doomer Optimism. And after he really coined that term, some of the things that he wound up doing, getting into some nitty gritty specifics of the food, the energy, the water, the community, some of the other things that we talked about today. So be sure to check those out. I'll link to all that stuff if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/TuckerMax. And you can also leave your own comments or questions or tips for whatever your favorite prepping magazine over there as well. Tucker, anything else that you want to leave people with as far as a word of advice?
You know, I honestly, one of the shifts I've made in this whole process is I don't give advice. I don't tell people what they should do. I think that's a huge part of sovereignty, is realizing that everyone's on their own journey.
Other than telling me that I have to have a vacation home.
Now, what I do is I've shifted my perspective. And so I tell people what I'm doing, and I tell people what I've learned and what I've seen. And I respect their ability to make up their own mind, which is, to me, the key of sovereignty, is not just being sovereign for yourself, but respecting the sovereignty of others.
That makes sense. I like it. And it would create a lot less dogmatism and scapegoating if people did approach things with that mentality. So, Tucker, I'm grateful to you for giving your time, sharing all this stuff with us, writing what you do right, and being who you are, man. You really are doing a lot of good for the world.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
All right. Cool, man. Well, I'll catch you on the flip side. And folks, until next time, I'm Ben Greenfield along with Tucker Max from bengreenfieldfitness.com/TuckerMax. Signing out. Have an amazing week.
More than ever these days, people like you and me need a fresh, entertaining, well-informed, and often outside-the-box approach to discovering the health and happiness and hope that we all crave. So I hope I've been able to do that for you on this episode today. And if you liked it, or if you love what I'm up to, then please leave me a review on your preferred podcast listening channel, wherever that might be. And just find the Ben Greenfield Life episode. Say something nice. Thanks so much. It means a lot.